What? The food? What? 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 I mean, this is an area of history that's just, like, so deep.
And over the baguette.
Themes of empire, mission, inheritance, and destiny. Hello and welcome to What the Food. This is a podcast that aims to uncover the fascinating origin stories behind dishes from all around the world, both popular and obscure. My name's Miles, and as always, I'm here with Andy, and together it's our mission to delve into history and to give you a new appreciation for dishes that we eat. Today's episode takes us on a journey to the origin of
Apfelstrudel! Apfelstrudel!
Yeah, so today's food was personally requested by Miles himself.
Andy, I just really want to know more about an Apfelstrudel, please.
That's not the case. I reckon there's a deep inside you, Miles, lives a little chubby Austrian boy named Gunther. Gunther enjoys...
Hello, I'm Gunther. I want to have a delicious Apfelstrudel tonight. Yep.
You enjoy frolicking around the Burgenland in your tiny little Lederhosen.
Lederhosen.
And eating Mama's famous Apfelstrudel.
Mama's Apfelstrudel.
Like Sean Connery then. Oh yeah, so big fan of strudel then. Are we Miles?
Well, it's one of those food items that I have no idea about, and I'm just really interested in finding out.
You know who else was a fan of strudel?
Who?
Hitler. Just think about that.
That's what I've got in common. Me and Hitler. I don't know why. I don't know what drew me to wanting to know about it. It's just, I guess like with pastries, you kind of default to thinking that it's a French thing. Mm. Well, actually, I don't really know. I don't know whether strudel is German or Austrian or... I know it's that sort of rough area of the world, I just kind of wanted to, figure out
a bit more about it.
What the fuck's going on with strudel? Mm.
When was the last time you had strudel?
Mate, I can't even tell you. No idea.
You must see it in the shops that are like ready-made, good to go.
Yeah, I saw it today. We were in Wenzel's. It's like a pastry place in town.
And, what's it called?
We went in for a sandwich.
Wenzel's. Can you spell that for me, please?
W-E-N-Z-E-L-S.
There's a Z in it. Wenzel's.
Wenzel's.
Sounds magical.
It's really good. It's actually really good. It's a chain as well, I think. Is it? There's a few of them. So keep an eye out for a Wenzel's.
It's not like a pound bakery or out. Is it upmarket? Is it?
It's like a slightly upmarket Greggs. So like they do pastries, but the sandwich is a bit more expensive and the ingredients. But they also make fresh sandwiches. So you could. So if they don't have any that you want, you can
sort
order
of Pickles Farm type situation.
But they also then sell bread as well. So there's like a little bakery section where you can go in and buy loaves of different things and
big old sourdough.
Yeah, and they've got like a really good pastry section. There was like yum yums and donuts, but there was apple strudel in there today, and I saw it. I said to Joanna, I'm going to be fucking talking about it.
Should have got one. This could have been the first time where one of us is eating the food that we're talking about whilst talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going on, and I'm just like.
Chowing down on
strudel. Really? That's amazing.
I can really.
I can see it right here.
Taste the heritage.
I can taste the heritage.
It's all the history is just flooding my taste buds.
Yeah. You sound like Ollie Ball. Oh, yeah. Hi, it's Ollie Ball here. I can taste the amazing.
So you've not had it in a long time.
I missed an opportunity there, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. You've not had it in a long time. Fair enough. No. To be fair, I don't think I have either. With this whole thing, I think I've got a bit of an advantage because I've got an actual connection to the birthplace of strudel and I've eaten it many a times on my visits over there.
You've had the real shit then.
Do you know where I'm talking about?
I'm going to go with Vienna.
Yeah, that's correct. Absolutely smashed it. Yeah, mate, you walk through the streets of Vienna, you will see hundreds of people sitting outside a cafe, smoking a sophisticated cigarette whilst eating an apple strudel and sipping a cappuccino. That's just...
No way.
A regular occurrence, yep. No matter what time of the day, people out there, they absolutely love it. Like, the equivalent here is, like, what in the UK is walking down any high street with a load of closed-down shops, seeing people sipping a tin of Carling and shoveling a Greg sausage roll deep inside the mouth hole. That's about it, really.
Yeah, that is the British equivalent.
Yeah. Isn't it?
I was going to go with special brew, but you
special brew, yeah.
You saved
us
there a bit with the Carling. A slight notch better.
Yeah.
So they just sit outside and they just have it, do they?
Yeah.
Little takeaway cartons or something? I don't know.
It's just like a cafe. So
they'll just give you on a plate and you sit
outside. Exactly. Yeah. You just give it on a plate with your cappuccino and you just sit, drink, eat, have a cigarette, start your day, finish your
off
day,
you go.
Whatever you're doing, go back to work after your lunch break, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's actually one of the national dishes of Austria. And it's actually, very weirdly, it was the official state pastry of Texas between 2003 and 2005.
What, US Texas?
Yeah, US Texas. I couldn't find out how it, like, it blew my mind that, well, I didn't blow my mind. It kind of makes sense that the US has a thing such as a state pastry. It kind of makes sense to for the US.
Yeah, to be fair.
Yeah, like state pizzas, state cookies, probably got fucking anything. But I couldn't figure out why it was the official pastry and how it wronged the people of Texans to be removed in 2005 as a state pastry.
Yeah. Why was it denounced?
Apple strudel killed a dude.
Yeah. I mean, have they got like a large population of Austrians in Texas?
Well, no,
is there some kind
so.
Of like mass immigration so. Situation happening?
No. I read one comment where someone was like trying to explain it. Well, they didn't really try to explain it. They just said it was one of the first pastries made in Texas. But what the fuck? Like, how does this dude on Reddit know?
That's it. That's the first one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find any like legitimate sources on why apple strudel is the state pastry of Texas.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, obviously with McDonald's, you've got the apple pie, which is kind of like, you know, you could argue it's a variation of apple strudel. It's got this...
Oh, no.
No, don't fuck with me, mouse.
Don't fuck with me now, mouse.
All right, fair enough. I'm
You'd
just
have been castrated
in Vienna.
In Vienna,
from comparing a McDonald's apple pie.
Yeah, to a strudel.
What the fuck are you talking about? It's got no fucking connection whatsoever. So fuck yourself.
Sorry.
So fuck yourself.
I don't know. I'm just trying to create some kind of connection that there apparently isn't. So
yeah, well, no, that's good. Let's start by getting into what a strudel actually is. You know, I think that will give you a good idea of how much trouble you're in. So a strudel is a type of sweet or savoury layered pastry with a filling inside. Sweet or savoury, interesting, isn't it? Mm. So yeah, the pastry is your basic or your classic filo pastry, so you know, dead thin layers that are layered on top of each other until you have a thick layer, basically.
Buttery, thick, flaky,
delicate. Once your pastry is laid out, you can then turn your attention to the filling side of things. Most cases, the filling will be fruit related, most commonly apple, which we weren't talking about today. But you can also get sour cherry, apricot, you know, that sort of stuff.
Delicious.
Yes, savory strudels are a thing as well. If you've had a savory strudel,
no, what's going in those?
Yeah, so common fillings for those include chicken and rice, mushroom and leek, and ham and cheese,
and pate.
Yeah, funnily enough.
All right, so that's like it's got pasty vibes going on there, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So with your pastry and your filling ready to go, you are going to want to empty your filling onto the pastry, roll that guy up. Enclose all of the filling, and then bake that guy until he's golden brown. That's it.
Any sugar on top or anything afterwards?
So for savoury, no. Maybe you'd put a bit of pepper, maybe some sesame seeds, that sort of thing.
Yep.
But for sweet, yeah, you can put a bit of powdered sugar on top. I don't think they usually bake it with sugar on, because I think that would burn the phyllo too much.
Yeah, caramelise
cook too much. Maybe you could put it on like 10 minutes towards the end, maybe, just to caramelise it up a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's simple enough, really. It's just like you said, it's kind of like pasty vibes, isn't it?
Yeah.
But of course, as with anything, there are levels to this game. There's levels to the strudel game. So what we've just described is like a lazy way of doing strudel. We just like bang all the filling in the middle and just roll it up. The proper way to do it is to layer as you go, kind of like a lasagna. So this way you have like interwoven layers of filling and pastry that deliver like a, you know, kind of like a whirlpool like pattern.
So you're doing a little bit of filling, then a bit of the pastry over the top, then a bit more filling,
exactly.
Instead of it's just all lumped in.
Yeah, exactly. So when you cut into it, you've kind of got like a whirlpool, you've got like a swirl almost. And funnily enough, this is where the name strudel comes from. The word strudel comes from a High German word meaning whirlpool.
Ooh.
Boom.
Whirlpool.
Strudel.
Don't fall into the whirlpool.
Don't fall into that strudel. It's funny that, though, isn't it? Like, there's so many foods out there that are just called something just because of how they look.
Yeah, yeah. Just like one word that's translated just into one something. Word. Yeah. What did we say the other day? It was like Pomodoro tomatoes. They were called like...
Golden apples.
Golden apples, that was it.
Mm. Golden or like apples. Paella being named after the pan which it's cooked in.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Crazy, isn't it?
But yeah. Little interesting tidbit for you there. That's what like a proper Austrian strudel or a proper authentically made strudel should be like.
If you went to like an artisan proper. Yeah,
exactly. The stuff that we have over here and the stuff that you'll find like ready-made in like Sainsbury's, Tesco's and stuff like that, that's just like our westernised, not westernised because Austria's in the west, but like a bastardised version of it. You know, you're still going to get the sort of the same texture, I suppose, because it's still like layers of, you know, thin filo pastry, but you're not going to get the whole whirlpooling effect. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Right. So now we know what the hell a strudel. Let's get into the origins of this delectable whirlpool, shall we?
Oh, I was just going to say, before we move on, is the apple strudel the default? With us looking at apple strudel in particular, we're not ignoring the more any more important
versions. No, the apple strudel is definitely the default. The others are variations and usually depend on what's in season.
Okay, got you.
So they'll just stew up a load of fruit that's left over that's just going out of season or something like that, or they
or
will...
if you live on a mountain and that mountain has got peaches, then you might be having some peaches in your strudel.
Mm.
Just switch it up for whatever you've got available.
Yeah. If you've got any, you know, cheese lying about, throw some fucking...
We've got a really, really bad infestation at the moment of rats. So our strudels are coming out very strange, but they're okay.
Rat strudel.
They're okay.
Yeah, so basically it's just whatever's in season, whatever's lying around, whatever you've got an abundance in, just stick it in the strudel. Mm. But yeah, most commonly apple. So if you were to ask the majority of people what country apple strudel originated in, I would say 8 out of 10, maybe even 9 out of 10 would answer Germany. Is that what you thought?
I thought it was Germany or Austria.
So apple strudel, as we've just mentioned right at the beginning, originated in Austria, the musical centre of Europe. Vienna. So we know this as the earliest known strudel recipe dates back to 1696 and still survives to this day in a handwritten cookbook in the Vienna Town Hall Library.
So they know that's the first one and they've still got the very...
They've still got the very first one. So there's two recipes which are contained within this handwritten cookbook. The first one is a sweet milk cream filled strudel, kind of like a pastry cream type thing. Okay. Kind of like it's kind of like, I think like the cream was like whips and stuff like that, so it's like thick cream.
It's not just like it's sloppy, like
just wet cream just pouring out. Yeah,
just that's dish just out strudel. Just...
Okay, sorry. Yeah, so it's like nice fluffy whipped cream in there.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think so. Yeah, and the name of that is Milliramstrudel.
Milliramstrudel.
It's probably not got that raham. It's not Arabic.
That sounded so Arabic.
So Arabic. It's called Milliramstrudel. it's called Milliramstrudel, some shit like that. We ain't getting points for pronunciation.
No one's testing us.
No, exactly. And the second one is And the second recipe is for a savoury turnip strudel, which sounds fucking grim.
Thanks. Yeah, I don't know though, because like when I once followed a recipe for a courgette cake, and it was like a variation of a carrot cake, and it was like, you know, brown but dark worse. Sugar, but fucking grim, mate. No, it's actually really good, but you know, it's like the same concept. You've got the dark brown sugar, you're creating a dark moist cake. You've got, you know, a cream filling on top, and it was made with shredded courgettes, and it was actually banging.
Little question for you. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to squeeze all the water out of that courgette?
A long time. Yeah. That's a nightmare, that job, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the worst. Yeah, isn't it's it? The worst. Was it actually decent, though? Did it taste a courgette?
No, didn't take a... Well, I don't know. It just tasted like... In the same way that you can't really taste carrots in a carrot cake, was the same with this. It was like, it didn't taste like you were eating courgette.
Was it green? You like bits of green in
little
it?
Little bits of green in it, yeah. It was really good. It was really, really nice. I've never made one since for I don't know why, but...
That must have been fucking good.
Yeah, it must have been amazing, man. But no, I think, like, you know, the sound of a turnip strudel on paper just sounds pretty grim, but I think we'd be surprised, probably.
Maybe. I mean, this was savoury. This wasn't trying to be a sweet thing.
Maybe not.
This was your... This is like, basically, would you eat a turnip pie? A turnip-filled pasty, maybe?
I'm good. Okay. Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Point taken.
Little history lesson, I think, before we go any further, but also this history lesson kind of gives you an idea and a feel for what Austria and Europe as a whole were like during the period in which we first see these recipes. We first see the strudel recipes come to light.
Okay.
Now, we're only going to be touching on sort of key elements here. We're not going to go sort of ham into the history of the Habsburgs and the complicated history that makes up the Holy Roman Emperor and the Empire and shit like that. Like,
I mean, this is an area of history that's just like so deep that, like you said, we just wouldn't have time to go into for this episode, but...
Yeah, no, it's unreal. Like, I got lost in it just doing the research for this. I just spent hours just reading like battle logs and like...
Yeah.
But yeah, we just want to give you a flavour for the time period and what's happening. That's what we want to do. So in 16...
a bit out there.
Yeah. Fuck's sake. Fucked it already. So in 1696, when this older strudel recipe dates back to, Austria is part of the Holy Roman Empire, ruled by Holy Roman Emperor Leopold I.
Right, okay.
So Austria at this point is a super important place. Right. And one historian called Martin Rady writes,
Austria was not just the location. It was also a land whose rulers were predestined for greatness and government. Indeed, Austria was not really a land at all, but a learned construction that brought together the themes of empire, mission, inheritance, and destiny. It signalled a set of beliefs about the ruling house that stood apart from geography. When the Habsburgs spoke of Austria, they were signalling an idea as much as a space.
It's cool, isn't it?
Really cool. So it's like an ethos, a way of operating as much as it is a location.
A location, exactly, yeah. Wow. It's a place that's that brings together all of those themes that you mentioned of empire, of mission, of inheritance, of destiny. It's like
Is Austria of any geographical importance in its location, like port-wise or trade route-wise? Is it because...
So it's on the Danube. Vienna's built on the Danube, which is like one of the biggest rivers in Europe, if not the biggest.
Right, so it's just going to be a hot spot for trade and
exactly. It is also like very in the middle of a lot of countries, like connects to Germany, obviously, connects to Italy, connects to Hungary, it connects to Slovakia.
So yes, strategical place to operate from.
It's a good place. And it's also, I think this quote, the fact that it's talking about how it was a it was not just a location. I think that sort of is demonstrated by the amount of like important people that came from Austria. Like you've obviously got all your musicians, all your philosophers, all your not so nice people,
Adolf Hitler.
You know, it was a place where just ideas were cultivated. Important place. So during Leopold's reign, he actually successfully held off numerous attacks from the Ottoman Empire on his lands.
Wow. They're Turkish, aren't they, the Ottomans?
Turkish, exactly right, yeah. And probably the most important victory was the Battle of Vienna, where Leopold and his army defeated the Ottomans and put a historic end to the expansion of the Ottoman Empire into Europe.
Wow. So he literally stopped that going any further.
Yeah, exactly. So the Ottoman Empire, obviously through Turkey, I think they owned a lot of the Middle East, or at least a lot of like Iran and stuff like that at that point. They were expanding up through like Serbia and sort of those countries, all the way up into Hungary, which is obviously borders Austria. And
so they made it like quite far then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like where Vienna is situated, it's in like the southeast of Vienna, and it's like right on the border almost between Vienna and Hungary.
Right.
So like if that would have fallen, you know, the rest of Austria would have fallen.
Yeah, and then Europe after that as well, the rest of Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
That would have unlocked sort of the routes further up. And I mean, I've only looked a little bit into the Ottoman Empire in the past, but they apparently just had like the best fleets. They were just like the one of the best on the sea, apparently. Travelled the world and mapped the whole world and stuff.
Yeah.
Mad bastards.
So yeah, basically at this point in time, Austria is part of a much larger entity in Europe. You know, it's not just Austria. It's the Holy Roman Empire, which is made up of places like Hungary, Germany, Belgium, Prague, you know, all sorts of places like that, countries and cities like that, you know, and it was ruled, all these places were ruled by one inbred dude called Leopold, who we just spoke about.
Was he actually inbred? Confirmed.
Yeah. So Leopold was part of Europe's most influential and royal houses, which was called the House of Habsburg. So the House of Habsburg produced kings of Spain, kings of Portugal, kings of Croatia, Hungary, Bohemia, and even emperors of Austria and Mexico.
Fucking hell. This house this one was family.
Powerful. Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But although they ruled, like, obviously distinct territories, you know, completely different from one another, they nevertheless maintained close relations with one another and frequently intermarried. Keep it in the family, basically.
Keep the bloodline pure.
Exactly. They would marry their cousins just to keep their pure-blooded dynasties alive.
Just retarded, isn't it? Like.
Yeah, exactly.
Bet they were all ugly fuckers as well.
Oh, mate, yeah, we'll get onto it. We'll get onto it. So, for example, Leopold's mum was Maria Anne of Austria, and his dad was Ferdinand III, Holy Roman Emperor. They were first cousins. So his mum and dad were cousins.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, mate.
Ugh.
Yeah. So the inbreeding got so bad that members of the Habsburg dynasty developed potentially disfiguring genetic disorders.
Did they not at any point think maybe we should stop doing this and like, you know, bring in some new genes into the gene pool?
No.
No.
I'm going to say
your
no.
answer. It's just no.
No. Because they didn't, like DNA and shit, I don't think anyone, they didn't know about that at that time. They didn't understand
that.
So
it's not like
that.
They understood what they were doing, but preferred to keep the dynasty clean. It's the fact that they actually don't think that they understood that that was having the effect. Just thought, fucking hell, we're an ugly family.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't understand, or maybe they just didn't really care because they were so content on keeping it in the family and keeping the bloodline pure. They just didn't even think to even look into why of all our kids
got three eyes looking. And four fingers on.
The funny thing is with these guys is that they had a, it was like a distinct thing that they had. Right. So all of the Habsburgs had this thing where their lower jaw outgrew the upper jaw. Yeah, exactly. So that the lower jaw keeps growing and then their upper jaw is basically either regresses or it stays the same. So you've basically got, you like, extend your jaw all the way out. Like your bottom. Yeah, that's what they were like all the time. Like,
oh,
talking
God,
like
that.
Hello.
Hello. I'm in Vienna. Give me a slice of that strudel, please.
Give me a slice of that strudel, please. Oh, that's horrible. That's really horrible.
Mate. Yeah, mate. It was so associated with him that it actually became known as the Habsburg jaw or the Austrian lip.
God. Everyone's aware of it.
And on every single portrait, because obviously these were like kings and queens, like royal portraits, you know, where they're like standing holding scepters and stuff. You can see it. You can see the jaw is just whack looking, and it's like well long compared to their upper jaw.
I mean, you'd have thought that they'd say like to the artist, like, can you reshape my jaw for the purpose of this picture? Yeah. Right, so they're inbreeding, they're all fucking disfigured, got massive chins, keeping the dynasty alive.
Yeah, exactly. Just for that reason. So a great quote on one of the more affected family members, Charles II of Spain, comes from allthatsinterest.com. They say,
Charles II's most prominent feature was his jaw, known as the Habsburg jaw, which identified him as part of his royal family. His two rows of teeth could not meet. Charles II's tongue was so huge he could barely speak. He was not allowed to walk until he was almost fully grown, and his family didn't bother to educate him. The king was illiterate and totally dependent on those around him.
But he was king of Spain.
What should we do, Charles? Okay.
Mental, isn't it?
Yes, Your Grace.
His two rows of teeth could not meet, so he couldn't close his jaw.
He was unable to chew food. His tongue was so huge he could barely speak, and he wasn't allowed to walk until he was almost fully grown, and his family didn't bother to educate him. I mean, yeah, those policies were coming from someone else, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could say his wife, but I think his wife also said that he was so ugly as to cause fear.
My God.
She also said that he looked constantly ill and she didn't want to be around him.
Oh, poor sod. He didn't ask to get born. It's just his fucking incestuous parents.
Exactly.
Poor little Charles II.
Yeah.
Anyway, did he die young? Probably.
Yeah, probably. I don't really know.
We'll hazard a guess at that one.
Probably choked.
His wife choked probably on his choked him.
Huge tongue. No, I know that he married twice. I know that he had two wives.
Oh, wow. He's done better than me. Never mind.
So yeah, this doesn't really have anything to do with Schrödl, but it should give you a quick background on what's going on in Europe at the moment. Basically, you're living under inbred rulers who can't chew their food, and you're absolutely cream crackered from fighting off waves and waves of Turks that are invading your homeland.
Yep.
Rough, really. But Schrödl fans, don't be too critical against those Turks now. You likely have those Turks to thank for part of strudel's origins. Like with many dishes, apple strudel is a fusion of different cultures. The pastry most often used is a thin sort of phyllo pastry that was most likely invented by the Turks, although the Greeks do lay a strong claim to it.
So this is just more of a general use of phyllo pastry in this way sort of thing, like...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so the Turks or the Greeks, basically, it's still like an ongoing thing, an ongoing war, really, about who invented phyllo pastry. But these two cultures are thought to have invented it.
Yeah, because thinking about it, like, obviously, Turkish cuisine has an emphasis on pastry. You know, they have the baklava or whatever it's called.
Oh, that's literally in my next sentence.
Oh, is it?
Oh, so good.
You're so good. I'm so good. We're so good. But
no, but go on. Say what you're going to say.
Well, they just, you know, whenever I've gone into Turkish supermarkets here in London, they you know, they always have an impressive pastry section. You know, it's clear that it's an integral part of their sort of identity and national cuisine. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, they were messing around with phyllo pastry before the Austrians.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, you just nailed it, really. Like, baklava, its origins date back to, like, the 8th century. So, like, 8 centuries before Schrödl, which we'll definitely do an episode on at some point.
Baklava. Yeah, 100%.
So, if you think about it, what is it? It's like a paper-thin layers of pastry, but filled with, like, chopped nuts, honey or syrup, that sort of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely. It's usually got pistachios on the top, hasn't it? Or something.
Yeah, pistachios or pecans or whatever nuts they got lying about, really.
Yeah, cause it's like a chewy phyllo pastry thing, isn't it? It's nice.
Yeah, exactly. We've already mentioned that it dates back to the 8th century, and over time, chefs making baklava, the way that it kind of adapts is that they just try to outdo each other. They try to outdo each other by making the pastry thinner and thinner with more and more layers, just trying to outdo one another, you know?
Man, it's so thin you can't even see it.
Basically, yeah. No, basically, they would try and make it as thin as possible, and then they would present it to the sultan, you know, the chief, and be like, look, I've made the thinnest baklava for you.
There's nothing on my plate. No, it's so thin you can't see it.
You can't see it.
Whoa, give this guy a promotion.
It blew away in the wind. Yeah. Right, so we've got phyllo pastry knocking around in Turkey. Most probably Greece as well, but we'll stick with Turkey. So the idea of this thin paper-like dough perhaps comes to Vienna through Turkey sometime between the late 15th to 17th century. So obviously you've got the Ottoman Empire and the Holy Roman Empire. They're obviously not mates, but even though they're not mates, you're still going to have some trade and you're still going to have some connection. So it could be that it's passed on sort of during this.
Well, that's the thing. When countries are at war with each other, it's the governments and the leaders that are at war, not the people. Mm. So, you know, when there's trade paths crossing, average tradesmen are just going to crack on as normal, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
The country is at war, but the people, not necessarily.
The people aren't. Yeah. So it could have happened that way. But to be honest, I think it's way more romantic this way. The passing on of the pastry could have occurred when Austria was attacked by the Ottomans during the Battle of Vienna that we spoke about on the 12th of September, 1683.
The soldier dropped his baklava out of his back pocket.
Oh, no.
This looks very good.
Blew over the walls in the wind. So... just because it's a battle, we're just men and we like talking about warfare. Let's chat about the Battle of Vienna.
Fuck yeah.
So the Battle of Vienna involved...
Fuck yeah.
The Battle of Vienna involved 150,000 Ottomans with around 150 cannons versus around 90,000 defenders. So... pretty decent numbers advantage for the Ottomans, but obviously the defenders most 9 times out of 10 have the advantage, and in this case they did. So the Ottomans lost around 20,000 men during the siege leading up to the battle, whilst the defenders lost just 12,000.
Is that because they've just got the defences of the city to their benefit?
Yeah, exactly. If you think about it, like you're trying to siege like high city walls, you have to get siege equipment in place. I don't know if they're using trebuchets, probably using like battering rams.
And they're just pinging you with arrows this whole time.
They're just pinging you with arrows. Cannons. I think they had muskets at this point. So, like, guns, artillery, shit like that. Yeah, so the Ottomans lost around 20,000. Defenders lost around 12,000. For the actual battle itself, I think that happened sort of within Vienna. So, like, when the walls were sieged.
But that was a bit more even then, was it, by that point?
Yeah, it was a bit more even. But I think the Ottomans still suffered much higher casualties. I think they had 15,000, while 7,000 dead for the defenders. So it was a pretty big boy battle.
Yeah.
So one of the leaders of the defenders, John III of Sobieski, King of Poland, wrote to his wife after the battle that
ours are treasures unheard of. Tents, sheep, cattle, and no small number of camels. It is victory as nobody ever knew before. The enemy now completely ruined. Everything lost for them. They must run for their sheer lives. General Strachenberg hugged and kissed me and called me his saviour.
Beautiful. So yeah, I think the reason I wanted to include that quote is it basically just summarises how much they fucked them up, how much the Ottomans lost and how much they did lose, basically, because of the result of this battle.
So who was the General Starenberg? Was that just one of the generals of the Austrian army?
Yeah. So the leader of this defence, I think, was the King of Poland.
Right.
Because obviously, as we said, like, Austria encompasses all the different areas around Europe at that time. A lot of different areas of Europe around that time. So I think John III of Sobieski, I think he led the defenders. I think General Starnberg is just one of the generals that was working with him.
And hugged and kissed him and said he was his saviour. Mm. Very appreciative gentleman.
Very appreciative. So I have a theory, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, during this time, armies were slow-moving entities that carried a lot of shit with them, right? They had stuff like provisions, tents, living quarters, stuff like that.
Horses, battering rams.
Exactly, yeah. They had supply lines, you know, with these sorts of things being carried to and from their location, but primarily they would have just carried the majority of stuff with them.
Yeah.
Now, it's likely that in defeat, they would have left all that shit behind and just scarpered out of there. You know, all the Ottomans, they've been defeated, let's just get out. To me, it would seem very likely that within the stuff that they left behind was a couple of sheets of phyllo pastry.
Ooh. They're going to have provisions, aren't they?
Yeah. Rations, a couple of baklava that's just lying around, or like some baklava that was just being made, or, you know, they were so keen on it, surely they would have brought it with them.
Yeah.
Maybe not like the everyday soldiers, if it was like a rich person's treat, but maybe the generals.
Well, the other thing as well is that it's probably like, it carries quite well, you know, if you bring a few bags of flour with you and some dried nuts, both of those ingredients on their own in their raw form last a long time. And then, you know, when you get there, you incorporate whatever it is into the flour to create your pastry, and you grind up the nuts and you make the baklava. So feasible that it was something that they could take with them.
Really calorific as well. So it's a good...
High energy, good for battle.
Yeah. Mm. And like, obviously the winners of the battle, when they sifted through all the treasures that our mate John, of King of Poland, just talked about, you know, would have come across the pastry, and they would have asked one of the 10,000 prisoners that they captured during the battle, what was it? Boom, you got a phyllo pastry in the hands of the Austrians.
Boom, there it is.
It sounds good, and it works in terms of timings as well, because the Battle of Vienna took place in 1683, and the oldest strudel recipe is in 1696.
Okay, so
so it works that way as well.
Yeah.
It's all connecting.
Sherlock Holmes of the strudel world.
Sherlock strudel.
Sherlock strudel. And I'm Dr. Watson.
But despite all that, it's probably more likely that baklava was already being enjoyed by the Austrians in the 15th century. And they had basically years of experimenting with this thin pastry that led up to the apple strudel. I'm not sure, really. Yeah. My theory is more romantic, so therefore, I win.
That's the one I'm going with. I win. That's the one I'm going with. I mean, it's perfectly plausible. Yeah.
So what we are sure of is that from the 1690s onwards, strudel has well and truly arrived in Austria.
Every motherfucker is having this thing, and it's called strudel, yeah? Have you had it before?
Yeah,
get your apples,
strudel.
Crush them down,
bake them down with Weber sugar. No, apples yet.
Just very dry strudel, actually. It's very dry.
Just pastry.
It's really fucking dry, actually.
Now, you've got your milk strudel and your turnip strudel.
Ah, the emulsion strudel.
The emulsion strudel. My favourite.
So they have, so they're having the creamy one, aren't they?
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah, at this point. But from the 1800s onwards, you've got strudel recipes cropping up that are incorporating all types of ingredients. Right. Yeah, you had dairy-based strudels, including the one that we spoke about, the milk cream one.
Yeah.
Parmesan strudel, which sounds like it might be a bit tart. Like, Parmesan's quite a sharp cheese, isn't it? And just a strudel full of Parmesan.
I guess it would be a bit like a cheese stick.
Yeah, an intense cheese stick.
An intense cheese stick.
More of a cheese log.
Log, yeah, because it's flat, it's massive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Parmesan strudel, and you've got quark strudel, which sounds grim.
I thought it was a corn. I was like, fucking hell, they were ahead of their time, weren't they?
That's advanced.
It's vegetarian, plant-based. Strudel. What's quark? What is that?
So quark is made by when you warm sour milk and then it curdles and then you strain off the weird curdly bits and that's quark. Get that in your strudel and smoke it.
God. I mean, it's probably one of those things that on paper sounds disgusting, but this is why I keep going back to the idea that we need to set up the What the Food restaurant where we just serve people these ancient fucking old as fuck dishes in their original form. Come for some quark strudel.
Quark strudel.
$10.99.
Catches on delivery.
Yeah.
Not sure what it'd be like when it arrived.
Yeah. I can imagine that's a dish that does not travel well.
Absolutely.
But yeah, restaurant's coming soon. Keep your eyes peeled.
Keep your eyes peeled. Yeah, so you've got your dairy-based strudels. You've got fruit and spice strudels. So you've got apple strudel, apricot strudel, cherry strudel, cinnamon strudel, damson strudel, grape strudel, pear strudel. People love.
They feel quite wintry to me. You know, like when you incorporate spices into stuff like this, like you've got cinnamon and like star anise and all these kind of flavours, and it's a warm apple strudel. It feels like such a wintry, cold thing to have. So I don't know whether they were they eating it all year round.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because
they don't give a fuck, do they really?
No,
because I think over here we would have it more in the winter, wouldn't we?
Like that. Yeah. But I think there they have it all year round, and they just whenever a fruit is going to go out of season, they just acquire a lot of it and just preserve it somehow, or stew it up and keep it in a big jar, and then just use as and what you need for each strudel.
It's very economical use of it. Yeah.
Seasonal eating. So yeah, you've got fruit and spices. You've got grain strudel. So you've got semolina strudel. You've got rice strudel, which sounds odd, but
it's like having a rice sandwich.
Yeah.
A lot of carbs going on there.
Rice sandwich. Imagine. Isn't it? Imagine the dryness. We're talking like no butter either. No butter on the bread. No mayo or anything like that. Just rice.
Plain boiled rice.
Plain white boiled. No, plain brown boiled rice on brown bread.
But that seems, similar to what they're having there. Like,
But I imagine the rice is like flavored with all sorts of shit, though.
Yeah, like a moist, nice.
Yeah, cooked like a rice. Moist rice. One of them moist rices.
Hi, please. Can I have one of those? Can I have two portions of your moist rice, please?
Your most moist rice.
No, that one's not moist enough.
Stick your finger in it. Fucking swirl around.
Fucking hell. Rice, rice.
Rice strudels. And then finally, you've got your protein strudels. So you've got like beef strudel, chicken strudel, ham strudel, whatever.
Whey protein strudel.
Whey protein strudel. Creatine strudel.
Oh, I mean, the Arnold Schwarzeneggers need to come from something.
Well, you can't say that live on a podcast, that word.
What?
What did you say?
Schwarzenegger.
Oh, right, there you go. Nager, yeah, sorry.
Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, but you didn't say that. You didn't say that.
Did I not?
No. You listen back through this.
Oh, no. Did I?
Yeah.
Did I say it wrong?
You said it a bit wrong, yeah.
Right, well, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
There you go. Nager.
Has to come from something.
Yeah. Exactly.
Was the joke.
Was the joke.
It's now long gone. Oh, God. Move on, please. Save me.
Move on. Right. So basically, Austria has been gripped by strudel fever, and they're just chucking in all sorts of shit in there and seeing what slaps, really. Now, for the apple variety, which we're mainly focusing on today, some claim that the dish was invented in Vienna for the Emperor of Austria and the rest of high society that was obviously knocking around at this point. But I don't know. I don't really see it, to be honest. Like, stewed apples with various spices sort of dates all the way back to like the 12th or 13th century. So people have been dealing with the filling for a while. It was just kind of pastry that was new.
Yeah, and it's also a relatively cheap thing. I mean, I don't know how easy it was for the working class people of the time to get their hands on flour and butter and things.
Well, I think the flour and stuff would have been fine. It's more the cinnamon, yeah. raisins, that sort of shit might have been a bit more difficult.
Wouldn't have been too much of a stretch for them to be able to make something that's reminiscent of apple strudel,
Is it, really? Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly right. So that's why I think kind of the whole apple strudel is made for the emperor and the rich...
A ploy to give it a bit more fucking...
Yeah, I think that's probably more the case. Yeah, like the whole calling some at French just to make it seem... fancier.
Yeah, yeah. It's like this was designed for royalty, and then everyone's like, oh, I want what's made for royalty.
So, yeah, depending on the recipe, you know, your apple strudel's got, obviously, apples, and then it's got additional stuff like raisins, cinnamon, rum, some of them have, nuts, such as like almonds, walnuts, that sort of stuff, maybe some nutmeg, maybe some ginger. So, yeah, much like baklava, chefs making the strudel, or Austrian chefs making the strudel, began to try to outdo each other by making thinner and thinner layers of pastry, but with more layers of them.
Right, okay.
The point of this was that it made the dish, the entire dish, a bit more impressive and achieved a greater sort of whirlpool effect that the dish was named after.
Look at the cross-section, bro. Look at the cross-section, bro.
I've got a cross-section, bro. It's basically it.
Right, like, basically check out my cross-section, bro. Cutting it in the middles, opening it up.
Just like turning it to the camera, like, oh, I see that, bro.
Yeah, check the cross section, bro. All these like, layers of thin pastry. Yeah. Essentially, that's what they were doing, though.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we've not changed at all as people.
No, we've just got different words for the same shit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, I came across a funny little story when it comes to sweet versus savoury strudels too.
Okay.
So an American 19th century writer called Alice Lee Moak wrote about an encounter with a savoury strudel ordered mistakenly as a dessert while she was in Croatia.
Oh no.
Here is what she had to say about the encounter.
Knowing that sprudel was a German sweet cake and seeing the word among the blue blurred hieroglyphics on the menu handed him, John ordered a sprudel for himself. On being served, the sprudel proved to be of huge proportions, so John proceeded to cut off a generous piece and put it on my plate. At the same moment, our nostrils were assailed with a horrible odour. I saw John suddenly lean over and spear with his fork the portion of the delicacy he had given me and quickly replace it on the dish. Calling a waiter, he ordered him, "Take it away, quick!"
She then goes on to say,
"When the man with the sprudel was gone, the sickening odour gradually passed away. John confessed he had taken but one mouthful and found it to be the most awful mixture he had ever tasted in his life. The sprudel had been sweet pie crust, as he had known when ordering it, but the filling, instead of being the luscious fruit or tasty jam he expected, was hot boiled cabbage. Not having recognised the combination written in German chirography, it turned out that he had unconsciously ordered the Austrian titbit known as Krautsprudel, and this time he got what he ordered."
Brilliant.
So what was that? Sauerkraut strudel, basically.
Yeah, so it was. Yeah, so he ordered a dessert, or what he thought was going to be a sweet strudel, a sweet cake, and it came out with a hot, like a savoury strudel full of cabbage. Hot boiled cabbage.
Hot cabbage. The disgust in the way she writes that as well.
Yeah, yeah. I bet, can you just imagine the waiters as well? I bet the waiters had a fucking field day.
Oh,
absolute,
God, yeah.
Like, knee-slapping comedy watching John tuck into what he thought was, like, going to be a nice, sweet dessert.
Sweet.
Only to be met with, like, a hot, steamy mountain of sauerkraut.
I mean, that has got to be one of the most unpleasant experiences as a human, is when you put something in your mouth expecting one thing. Yeah. And getting met with the complete opposite.
Complete opposite. Like,
it's only happened like a handful of times, but yeah. It's not fun, is it?
Oh, you love to see it. So yeah, so that's it really for the history of strudel. So it's a dish with a fairly straightforward history that involves a fusion of two cuisines.
Mm.
Apple strudel is enjoyed throughout the world, but you will simply not be able to find a better strudel than in Vienna.
Yeah, got to go to where it is. You got to go to it.
Exactly. Made by skilled Austrian confectioners that have perfected their craft over decades. Basically spent bare time layering out bare thin pastry.
Yeah, and it's probably their grandma's. Yeah. But the thing is, like, it's probably their grandparents' recipe and their grandparents' recipe. You know, it's been around so long, it's had time to be perfected. Mm. Like you said a second ago, like, there's only going to be one place you get it like that, and it's going to be Vienna, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So it's widely considered that the absolute best place to order and eat an apple strudel in the centre of Vienna is a place called Café Landmann.
Café
Landmann. It's L-A-N-D-T-M-A-N. Landmann.
Oh, okay.
So I've been to this place.
Have you?
Yeah, I've been, yeah. Café Landmann was founded by Franz Landmann on the 1st of October, 1873.
My God.
So old as fuck, and he's still going strong. Franz himself, I think he came from like a family of coffee house owners and gingerbread bakers and coffee manufacturers and shit like that. So he's...
Mom, I don't want to make gingerbread anymore. I'm sick of the gingerbread. I want to make strudel.
To make strudel is my true passion.
You do not make strudel. We make gingerbread and coffee.
But Mama, I want to make strudel.
And then he went to Landmann.
Then he went to Landmann, started it up. So, wow. I mean, yeah, so it's been around a long time, 1873. And during its long history, it's actually served as a meeting place for many of the leading politicians, thinkers, artists, industrialists in Austria. You know, a century ago in Café Landmann, if you walked in, you could have met Leon Trotsky, you could have met Joseph Stalin, Joseph Tito, Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, and Adolf Hitler, all on the same day.
Wow.
You could have met all of those people all on the same day. They were all in Vienna at that time, frequenting Café Landmann.
That's crazy. No mental way. What a hotspot.
Yeah, mental.
I mean, I wonder how many, you know, world-changing decisions were made over eating a strudel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, Joseph spent a month in Vienna. Trotsky wrote Marxism and the National Question whilst he was in Vienna. Or some of it in Vienna. Sigmund Freud moved to Vienna in 1860 and left in 1938. Adolf Hitler lived there between 1908 and 1913.
Was that his art phase?
That was his art phase, yep. Yeah. Trying to make it as a painter. His art phase. Tito was there. Trotsky was there. They were all there. Real melting pot of minds, just sitting around eating apple strudel. Sipping coffee.
Yeah. Like you said, you could have gone in there on any day back then and walked in and they could have all been in there.
Yeah. Mental.
Crazy.
Mad to think about.
Strudel. There we have it. Wow. Strudel. That was really interesting. Again, I didn't know anything about strudel and now I do. Next time I tuck into a strudel, which will be soon because I've now got a craving for one, I'll have a whole new appreciation for it.
Well, you know where to get one, don't you?
I know where. Wenzel's.
Wenzel's. Yeah.
Or when you come down, we'll go to Wenzel's. We'll get one.
Yeah, we'll get bloody Wenzel on the blower.
So I'm trying to think of news for people. We have an email address. Holy shit.
Get ready for this one.
You can send us an email if you want now. It's whatthefoodpodcast@gmail.com. Yes, it's Gmail. We are cheapskates and we have not bought our domain and we don't care. Send us an email. Let us know what you think of the show. Because we really want to know what you guys are thinking, if you're enjoying it, if you have any suggestions for dishes that you want to hear about. We're more than happy to respond to those and be cool to hear from people. So hit us up on the email, whatthefoodpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep. And all your negative comments, just send that to milesdickinson94
@gmail.com. Yeah, and I will take all of the negative comments so that Andy doesn't have to read them. Yeah, but yeah, we've got loads of episodes coming up, and some of them are going to be absolutely mind-blowing.
Maybe a July 4th special on the horizon as well.
Yep, because that's what we had that discussion, didn't we, Andy, where it was like, we want to try and tie in some holiday specials, you know, when it comes around to like Halloween, do some Halloween-specific food, whether it's like pumpkin pie or something. Well, that's more Thanksgiving, isn't it, pumpkin pie?
I think so. I think that the issue that we're going to have is Americans have specific national days for every single food.
Don't they? Too many. Yeah. Yeah, but there's going to be a few, though, isn't there?
Of course there is, yeah.
There's going to be loads. So that should be good fun. And we're going to keep them coming thick and fast. So, yeah, we do hope that you guys are enjoying them. Andy, good job with the research, as per usual. Absolutely nailed it.
Thanks, mate.
Again, I listened very well.
Very well. You were an excellent listener, I have to say. I honestly think you were better than last week. Just going to say that.
I think I'm getting better.
I think you're getting better. I'm not sure you're going to enjoy next week, though, with the topic that we're covering. I think it's going to make you squirm in your seat. A little hint there for people.
Squirm in our seat.
Yeah.
All right. Well, can't wait. Once again, thanks for listening, guys. And we will see you soon.
Ta-ta. Bye.
Ta-ta. Bye.
Yeah, that was a great episode. Still there, huh?